that cloud cover's breaking up a little bit. I can see some blue sky up there. It is 58 degrees, humidity 86% at 10 past 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to welcome back into our studios our good friend Nan Calvert, who joins us pretty much every month, all year long, to and brings with her always interesting guests and raises very, very important topics. And she has brought an anarchist with her today, but we should hasten to explain. It's not anarchist in quite the same way we typically think of that term. We're going to be meeting the owner of a farm in Mount Pleasant that is affectionately named Anarchy Acres. His name is Charlie Tennyson. We welcome you, Charlie Tennyson, to the Morning Show and to our studios. Nan, I want you to explain how you first met Mr. Tennyson and what prompted you to want to bring him here.
Well, I met Charlie many years ago through the Eco Justice Center, through a friend of ours, Sarah Wright. And then as time went on, Charlie became the president of the board of directors for the Eco Justice Center. And I was on the board and did lots of things out there. And over the years, it's been fascinating following Charlie's evolution as a farmer. And the reason I wanted to have Charlie on today was, one, it's really inspirational and it's deeply fascinating, the things that he does and why he does them, and the information he's pulled out about wheat varieties and farming in Wisconsin many, many decades ago. But it's also because there are different ways of doing things when you grow plants. And one of the reasons I'm so intrigued about what Charlie does is that, in part, it's very low impact. It leaves a very low footprint. And in truth, of course, it's not for everyone. But still, when you look at what he does and you learn about the whys and wherefores, you can take something away with you. And hopefully that inspires you to do something far less impactful on your own property. So there's many, many reasons why I wanted Charlie to be on today, but that's one of them. And we could go on for hours and hours talking to Charlie about this. Seriously, it's really amazing.
Right.
But unfortunately, we only have a little bit of time, so I'll be quiet now.
Well, don't be entirely quiet, but I'm so glad you brought Charlie Tennyson with you today. I think we have, you're right, absolutely all kinds of things to talk about. I didn't say in the introduction in so many words, but one of the things that you are well known for is the fact that you are raising varieties of wheat that were raised in the last century, or
yes,
the century before that, actually, in the 19th century. And we will explore some of the reasons why you have wanted to do that. First, let's make this relatively brief, if you don't mind. Let's hear your life story.
Okay.
Tell us actually where you come from and what in your background would have been predicative of this life that you're living now.
I grew up in the suburbs, Greg, and I went to the University of Wisconsin, Madison. My interest in farming, I can't explain it completely. I spent time on a farm growing up. My uncle was a strawberry farmer, and we were there for weekends, and I knew what a plant was and a weed and a plow and things like that. I circled back to it about 15 years ago when I landed on some space in Mount Pleasant, 4 acres, not a lot of space, which I now call Anarchy Acres, and I live alone there with some cats and a lot of other animals. And I can just explore and experience growing my own food and trying to be low impact on the land. And I found that there is a lot more than you'd think there. People need a lot of things. You need creativity in your life. You need a challenge. You need a healthy way to live. And you can get all those things on a 4-acre farm. There is more challenge there than you can imagine. There are things that need to be built, problems that need to be solved. There's fulfillment. There's beauty. There's things that work out. All the things that we seek as human beings, you can experience in a small space, adding and making the world a better place rather than subtracting and using up resources.
So nicely put.
That's how I got here.
Right. So, first of all, you did not grow up on a farm.
No.
And it also sounds like you didn't go to college to do this. I mean, you
were philosophy degree.
Oh, okay. So not agricultural studies. Okay. Well, you certainly have a philosopher's flair for understanding the deeper meaning of life and the way in which this has folded into this new life that you've built for yourself.
Sure.
Can you just take us back to that moment when you kind of took this plunge and decided to become a farmer? I mean, I suspect well before that, you already had maybe some of these intrinsic concerns about the earth and what it means to live a meaningful life, but that's not the same as becoming a farmer and starting your own farm.
Yeah, it's converged. I had worked with horses and trained horses, and I was intrigued. I was always intrigued with pulling things with a horse. And when I wound up with a donkey 5 or 6 years ago, that was my first experience with a draft animal. And now on Anarchy Acres, my 4-acre homestead, I've made a deal with myself that I won't use any gasoline there. Won't use the tractor and a little bit with a push lawnmower where my neighbors see it, so it's not awful. But in general, it's a petroleum-free zone, and I've now have 3 donkeys, and we do all the plowing and maintenance there, and they mostly eat the grass that grows on that 4-acre farm. So it's as close as you can get to a closed cycle. We're creating all the things. Anarchy Acres gets rain and sunshine, and it produces food. And while that's happening, the soil is actually getting better, and we're improving our little corner of the world rather than depleting it or being plugged into an oil well somewhere halfway across the world where the nutrients come from.
Right. How did you know what to do? And we're about to explore in detail a lot of what you do, including the varieties of wheat you found and so on. But how did you know how to do all of this? I mean, or how did you learn how to do all of this?
There's bits and pieces everywhere, and I think the only thing I've done that's possibly unique is just putting them together. Bread making, as I told you, Nan, I'm a serious home bread maker, and that's kind of what got me into wheat. And there were some bread baker's books that I read about that kind of pushed me into growing my own wheat and things like that. And there's a lot of people that have a great interest in using draft animals. There's an entire magazine. I've written for that magazine, Rural Heritage.
Huh.
And they're nuts about using draft animals to do farm work. And I put those things together. And I've also, the third thing I've decided to do is to use heritage varieties of wheat. One, because I think it's interesting. And two, because I think it's kind of untapped. There are many, many varieties of all the plants. Nan, you told me that there's something like 4,000 varieties of potatoes out there.
They were at one time. I don't know if they're still in existence. But
I know if you go to the USDA website and plug in wheat, or the Latin name for it, you get back 50,000 varieties that they have archived.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm focusing on varieties of wheat that grew in Wisconsin that I can tell from my research grew in Wisconsin at least 100 years ago. And my focus is I'm now focusing on 10 or 15 varieties from 1900 and earlier. There's more out there. I can't get all of them, but there's most of those I can get through seed banks from around the world. Put them in my test plot out back, grow them out, And if I like them, I'll eventually make them commercial quantities and put them in my big fields that I rent off the farm.
Hmm. I want to make sure people know who I'm talking to. For those of you just joining us, we have Nan Calvert in the studios, and with her today, Charlie Tennyson, who is a wheat farmer primarily in Mount Pleasant, kind of on the north side of Racine, and he calls his farm Anarchy Acres. And this is a farm that is 4 acres, entirely self-sustaining, about as low impact as you can possibly be. And we're going to delve into the world of wheat now for the next few minutes. Before talking about these beautiful heirloom varieties of wheat that you are raising, and Nan, why don't you chime in? We should talk about modern wheat, or normal wheat in quotations, but the kind of wheat that is typically grown when you drive through Kansas and you see it on either side of the road for as far as the eye can see. What kind of wheat is that? And what is wrong with that wheat that prompts you to want to seek out other varieties?
Yeah, my interest, I wouldn't say there's anything particularly wrong with new wheat. There are some advantages of the older wheat in an organic system that you don't have in a modern wheat. Modern wheat was made to grow, get all of its nutrients from intensive application of fertilizer. It has a very short straw because straw is not a valuable commodity anymore. But because it's so short, it doesn't compete with weeds very well. So in an organic system, modern wheat doesn't do that well. It's lower, you get more weeds, and it doesn't do as well. So but secondly, I'm more interested in the flavor and the romance that you get in an older variety. And also, from doing the research, it's very, very clear that varieties are capricious. Things get dropped, things become faddish, and they go. And I'm convinced that there's something out there from 100 or 200 years ago that's pretty, that just got pushed aside with the drive for the new. And so that's kind of part of what's driving me. I don't know that there's something that's so important back there, but I know that it's going to be interesting, and I'm going to learn something, and it's going to be beautiful.
You know, you mentioned your test plot just moments ago, where you put in varieties that you want to see if you like them. What goes into you liking a particular species of wheat?
There is a taste to wheat, and I eat a lot of kernels of wheat, and the taste will reveal itself in the bread or the pancakes or the pasta, all those things. Some wheat will make a stronger dough, and it's easier to work with if you want to make a really light dough. Some of them are weaker, and you might want it to be weaker if you were going to make a pastry or a cake or something like that. But it's a matter of personal taste. People like one tomato versus another, and the same can be true of wheat.
So it's not necessarily the height of a new species that you're trying or the density with which it grows. It's really all about the taste.
Yeah, taste and how well it grows, too. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting. We grew 2 very historic varieties of wheat next to each other this year. One was called Marquis, and one was called Red Fife. And both of them were very significant. In 1922, 2/3 of all the wheat grown in North America was Marquis. It's been gone since World War II, and that particular crop was only the 2nd crop since World War II in the state of Wisconsin, I believe. Next to it was Red Fife, and the Red Fife grew really well in that field, and the Marquis was okay. It wasn't as good as I thought, and I was really interested because the Marquis usurped the Red Fife. In other words, at some point they said, oh, we need Marquis, and we got to stop growing this Red Fife stuff. And for me, in this one same field, the Red Fife grew quite a bit better. So for me, in that field, Red Fife was the right choice that year.
And how does the taste differ between Red Fife, Marquis, Turkey Red?
Yeah. Turkey Red has the smoothest flavor. It has the most, umami, you know, just mm-hmm. that feeling of fullness. The flavor of Marquis is, to me, kind of the crudest. It's a little sharp. It's a little harsh. Red Fife, everyone that eats it says it's grassy. Huh. And if you can just understand what that mm-hmm. idea is, it's grassy. It's a nice flavor. It's a rich flavor, and it's got a grassy tone to it.
Hmm. Now, one of the things we haven't talked about yet is gluten. And my assumption was that at least part of what might be a great advantage to growing heirloom varieties of wheat popular a century or more ago is that the modern wheat we grow now is really high in gluten, and that's why we have so many people with gluten intolerance and so on, because the wheat that we're consuming and everything made from it is so high in gluten. Am I wrong about that, or does that sound correct?
Yeah, gluten is a complicated topic, and it's not completely studied and understood. Hmm. The most exciting thing I can tell you is, well, first of all, just back up. Gluten is a catch-all term for all of the proteins that are in wheat. There are many proteins in wheat. The two main ones are called gliadin and the unfortunately named glutenin. So those two make up about 90% of the proteins in wheat. Now, a baker will tell you that there's no gluten in here at all. Gluten only is developed once you add water to it. In other words, when a baker says gluten, they mean the gluten strands that are formed while you're kneading it. So we need three words to talk about what we're talking. And if you just hear the one and hear half this conversation, they'll start calling you and complaining right. that Charlie's telling you something that's wrong. But going back to wheat allergies, the most exciting thing that I've learned is that some older varieties, especially Red Fife, have a different ratio of the different proteins. And it's generally understood that gliadin is the one that causes the most allergies, the problems. In a modern wheat, 85% of the proteins in wheat is gliadin. In Red Fife, only 35% of the total proteins in wheat is gliadin. So it's really interesting to see that one particular protein that is thought to be the one causing allergies is so much lower, 60 or 70% lower, in an older variety of wheat. So has something happened when wheat has been bred to be more and more productive over the years? I mean, just kind of backing up, if you want, is there anything different than older wheat? Yes, there is gluten and protein in old wheat, no question about it. And if you have a true celiac allergy, you should not eat older wheat. But let's just look at this, back up. So Red Fife, when I grew it this year, it grew about 25 bushels to the acre. And my friend Mike was growing wheat this year, and he got 130 bushels to the acre. Now, can you even imagine that something is the same when it's that widely divergent? I mean, is it even correct to call it the same thing? This thing is making five times the more biomass out of the same field. And I think the likely answer is no, they're different. They're going to taste different. They're going to have different chemical makeups. And I believe, and a lot of people believe strongly, that older varieties of wheat impact people with allergies very, very differently.
Interesting. I think it would be great to hear about the sort of detective work or archaeological work or however we want to describe it that has been involved in you managing to procure what you need to grow all these varieties of old wheats, because it's not the kind of thing you go down to your local garden center and buy off the shelf. So take us through kind of what that process has been like. And where did it begin? What was the first wheat you raised at Anarchy Acres?
Yeah, that's a great question, Greg, and it brings up really the most exciting seed story that I can tell you. The first wheat that I grew was called Turkey Red. And it's probably the most famous heritage wheat in North America. Turkey Red was a very important wheat started in the 1870s. And it's a winter wheat, and there was a lot of Turkey Red grown for a long time. And even in the modern winter wheats, there's Turkey Red progenitors in there. So I became interested. I started growing it probably the first time in 2005, and it was just the recommendation of the baker that wrote the book that said I should grow my own wheat. And so I began growing Turkey Red, and I never thought about how do I know it's Turkey Red. Wheat in your hand, there's a picture of wheat in my hand. It looks like wheat. Okay. After looking at a lot of it, you can see small differences, but it looks like wheat. So somebody sends me a bag of wheat, and I pay him money. How do I know that it's Turkey Red? I discovered that there were quite a few different outlets growing and selling Turkey Red wheat. 2 years ago, I got seed from three of them, and I planted them side by side in my test plot. And I could see that all three were different. You, I mean, if you got your purple Cherokee seed from three different outlets and grew them, that's a tomato, and grew them in your garden, you'd expect them to look pretty much the same. These had some divergences. I got a fourth sample of Turkey red wheat from the USDA, and I also grew that in the test plot, and that also looked different.
Mm.
So now I had four. They had similarities, but they had differences. The most striking being that the two different samples I got from the USDA both produced a red stem. And this is not that red stem wheat. This is this particular turkey red I'm showing you right now is from seed that I got from Kansas State University.
For the radio viewing audience.
I'm sorry.
Charlie has
I know
wheat
it's radio.
For us to look at this.
He's brought his samples with him. And they're beautiful.
They are beautiful.
So that set off light bulbs, seeing the red stem in the archive samples that wasn't in the modern turkey reds. And then I started to dig deep, and I discovered that the turkey red that I got from the USDA actually was not held by the USDA for most of the 20th century. They collected turkey red back in the 1920s, and they lost it, okay, which happens. At the same time, some Russian scientists in St. Petersburg also collected some turkey red, and they collected it, and they held it for most of the 20th century. And that's the seed that I was able to plant and grow in my backyard. The remarkable thing is how that sample survived the 20th century, because it was in the Vavilov Institute in St. Petersburg, Russia, during the deadliest siege in human history. The siege of Leningrad in 1942, 1.5 million people died of starvation. And in the middle of that city, on the square, is the Vavilov Institute, where tons and tons of archived seed was held by these Russian scientists. And many of the Russian scientists felt so strongly that they guarded that seed. It could have been eaten and saved people's lives. Over a dozen of the staff of that place died of starvation during the siege to save the seed, because they thought it was important enough for humans to have and for the world to have. And when I discovered that some of that seed that people died for was growing in my backyard, I was flummoxed. Wow. I mean, I was just absolutely floored. Seed matters. Seed is important, and that story should tell you that it's important.
Wow. So I want you to describe to our listeners some of what has been involved, what's been involved in uncovering some of these other varieties and the lengths to which you've been willing to go to procure what you've needed to grow all these different kinds of wheat. I mean, especially some of the old documents to which you've turned and so on.
Greg, that's been fun, and that's going back to my alma mater, University of Wisconsin-Madison, which I just adore. And during the 1920s and earlier, the University of Wisconsin Extension, we all know about that, and did a lot of work with wheat, and there's lots of publications, and they're all on good old books.google.com, and you can go into them, do a word search on your favorite variety.
So, for instance, the document you're holding up right now from September of 1919 is wheat growing in Wisconsin, Bulletin 305 from the Agricultural Experiment Station of the University of Wisconsin. So if we looked through this, what would we find?
Well, this one was the one that really kicked me off, and it's almost like somebody went back in history and wrote a publication especially for Charlie in 2016. I mean, I peed in my pants and I saw it. And there's a couple more, Greg. Just, you know, here's the milling and baking qualities of Wisconsin-grown wheats. Not only did they grow it, they baked with it 100 years ago, took pictures of the wheat, of the bread. There's pictures of the loaf of bread inside here.
Can I see that one?
And
another bestseller from 1919. Sure enough, there are pictures of bread in here.
Yeah, from about 1919. So
showing the way in which different varieties of wheat would, I suppose, in a sense, behave in the baking process or in the bread-making process.
Yeah. So this particular, the first publication it asked me about had four recommendations for what to grow in Wisconsin. And this is written for farmers in 1919, what should you grow? And it said you should grow for winter wheat, either turkey red or something called Baxka. And for spring wheat, you should grow either Red Fife or Marquee. And I've grown all four of those since then. The Baxka, I've grown 2 years, and both times it's winter killed. It hasn't survived the winter. And it's really interesting on the Baxka, because everything I can tell says that we have milder winters now than we had in 1919. What I've concluded from watching the weather patterns is that our falls are so chaotic now that this particular variety of winter wheat can't go to sleep the way it needs to.
Mm.
In 1919, the fall went on a continuous slope downward. It would get 5 degrees colder every night, and it could properly go into senescence for the winter.
Right.
Now we're seeing Novembers that are bizarrely warm, and the Baxca last year, it was just there was about 2 days where it was like 60, 60, and then 40. And this thing needed to go 60, 58, 56, 54 over the course of 2 weeks. So interesting that a variety which was very well received in Wisconsin in 1919 can't grow here anymore.
Wow, it says something about what's going on. So when you decide that there is some kind of heirloom wheat that you are wanting to raise, then what do you have to do in order to make that possible, in order to find the seed to begin? Where do you go?
I look for seed banks, and the easiest and the largest one that I work with is the USDA Small Grains Collection, and that's very easy to work with. You go to their website, and you explain why you want the seed, and you do a search through their database, and if they have the seed, they'll send you 5 grams, which is about 100 seeds. Now, their seed isn't what came out of the field in 1919. They grow it out about every 20 years and put a fresh sample back into their vault.
Is it expensive?
It's free.
Oh, it's free?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's free. It comes out. If you have a valid a reason for wanting the seed, they'll send it to you for free.
So in other words, they want these seeds to be used.
Yeah, and it's not just wheat. Folks out there that have another interest, there's beans, there's corn. I mean, they just have, like I said, 50,000 varieties of wheat, as far as I know, in that stock and a lot of other stuff.
Wow.
And it's important. People have died for this, and people should preserve it. And it is best preserved as a active food source in our fields and our gardens. That's the best place for it.
Right. So on your 4 acres, how much is devoted to wheat?
Yes. The 4 acres is just for testing. So I have a half-acre garden on my 4 acres, and that's my food plot for myself. And I'm always growing out these small portions of wheat that I get from seed banks. Once it's big enough, I'll take it off my farm, and that's where I do, where I'll use a tractor and a combine and things like that. It's still organically grown, but I have rented fields off the farm for that.
And, oh, I see.
Yeah, so the wheat that I sell on my website or on my farm has been grown mostly off the farm because I grew about 15 acres of wheat this year.
Understood. Okay. So when you raise your wheat, what do you ultimately do with it then? Are you mostly selling it, or are you using some of it yourself?
I'm sure I'm the biggest consumer of wheat in my county because I eat a lot of it. I make pancakes, I make pasta, I make tabbouleh, I have bread a lot. I believe that the wheat and the bread that I make, being a whole grain, stone ground product, is very healthy for me. So far, that seems to be true. But I am trying to develop a business. So when I grew that 15 acres of wheat, I grew that this year with the intention of selling it. And I clean it and store it, and I have a stone mill on the farm, and I sell flour or the grain whole. And I do that either directly or through my website.
Right. And so typically, who would you be selling that to? I mean, are there stores that buy that from you, or individuals, or both?
Yeah, there's both. I have a range of small to medium-sized customers. And one of the Malachi Piglioli in Racine sells it, Molbeck's in Racine, Outpost in Milwaukee.
Sells your wheat or sells your flour?
Both.
Oh.
Wheat, berries, and flour. I sell directly. I'm happiest if I can just sell directly to a person. I mean, that's really what I prefer to do, is just sell it straight off the farm. And I do also have a website, and I'm selling it that way as well.
One thing that I wanted to mention, because Charlie is self-sufficient and also creative. So on his farm, he talked about his mill, which I believe you built, did you not?
I built 2 mills on the farm.
You built both of those. An oven.
Yes.
And also, didn't you make the yoke for your donkeys?
Yeah, all the things that the donkeys use to pull and pull are homemade. And that's another creative outlet. People like to solve problems and build things. the harnesses I've mostly built. Somebody gave me some harnesses. My good friend Joe gave me some harnesses that got me started, and I adapted them and built more parts. And like the last harness was pretty much all home built. So that got me going there. I discovered that because my donkeys are miniature donkeys, they couldn't pull a full-size century-old plow that I can find on Craigslist. So I began building my own plow, my own small disc, my own small cultivator, and things like that. So that's another great outlet. I get to use my welder and play in the workshop and make a product that will help me use the donkeys on my small property. The two mills that I built was kind of exciting to me because they're both stone mills. Stone grinding is a great way to make a really good quality flour. When you mill with stones, you crush the wheat and all the oils are kind of infused into the actual flour. You get a wonderful flavor. It's a perishable product. It should be used in the next 6 months. It's not like white flour that you can use for years and years. You should either use it within 6 months or refrigerate it. But the flavor and the floral tones that you get from stone milling are just fantastic. And building a stone mill, I think I probably built the first stone mill in Wisconsin in a century's time. I did it the same way that, and this was a stretch, I guess, but I did it the same way that George Washington did it, because I ordered my stones from Europe. And that was a very common thing to do. George Washington, if you look, he ordered his millstones from France. I ordered mine from Denmark, and they came, and I built everything else around that. And I have the mill running on the farm now, and I can make fresh flour. And that's something that's important for my business, I believe, because I rarely let flour sit around. I don't have much flour in stock at all. When I get an order, then I fire up the mill and fill the bag. And so it's as fresh as it can be.
And what drives the mill? I mean, how does the mill operate? What moves the stones?
Yeah, this mill has a 15 horsepower motor, the one that I use right now. And I've done the full gamut. My first stone mill that I've been using for most of the last 10 years for personal use is a bicycle powered stone mill.
Why am I not surprised? For those of you just joining us,
don't make me sound crazy, Greg. Come on, make me look good.
Well, you look good. On today's morning show, we have Nan Calvert, and she's brought with her Charlie Tennyson, who is the owner of a most intriguing farm located in Mount Pleasant towards the north side of Racine called Anarchy Acres. And Charlie Tennyson specializes in raising heirloom varieties of wheat on his 4 acres there and on other farmland that he rents or owns? Or
off the farm, I rent farm.
Okay.
Farmland, yeah.
And one of the things he's proudest of is the sort of cycle of sustainability with which he does pretty much everything on this farm. So talk for a moment about that. What are the most important ways in which you do your farming to have the lightest possible impact on the earth?
When I think of sustainability, I came up with a tagline that I'll use occasionally when I talk about this. I call it follow the fertility. All three of us in this room are old enough to remember where that comes from. When you have a political scandal, we're told to follow the money. Mm. I think if you have an environmental or a sustainable crisis, you should follow the fertility. So when you look at a field, where did the fertility come from to create that food? And in North America, most of us eat the equivalent of 400 to 500 gallons of gasoline every year. So in other words, the food that we eat requires energy inputs of 400 to 500 gallons of gasoline every year. And about 2/3 of that energy is in the form of chemicals, petrochemicals, fertilizer, fungicide, pesticide that are put onto the fields. And the rest of it is for the tractors and the transportation. And what's important to me is, where does it come from? Well, we know that petroleum comes out of the ground, and for me, there's always violence associated with it. Violence to the earth. Men and women fight over it. And it's going to run out someday. Now, we have a system of agriculture that's been feeding humanity for 10,000 years. And for most of that 10,000 years, it wasn't powered by petroleum. It was powered by animals. And to me, that's beautiful, and it's sustainable, and it's practical. You've probably traveled to old cities, the old part of New York, you're in Europe. When you go in the middle of London and you look at those old buildings, you're looking at a place that was built with animal-powered agriculture, okay? There were doctors, there were lawyers, there were farmers. Animal-powered agriculture can produce a surplus. Some people can be farmers. Some people can live in the city. We can have a civilization that looks like ours, and it can go on for centuries. It can go on for 10,000 years. The current system that's powered by petroleum has been around for about 75 years. Really, it was World War II when we tipped over from using horses on the farm to using tractors and then putting more and more chemicals on the farm. So the new system has been around for 75 years. The old system was around for 10,000 years. If you go to BP's website, I think it still says that they think we're going to run out of oil in about 50 to 60 years. So we've traded a system that worked for centuries for a system that is possibly going to run out, and it's destructive to topsoil. It's unhealthy. It's violent. And my interest is in exploring some of the good parts of the old system. Mm. Like I said, on my four-acre farm, I get just really everything that I need to live a fulfilling life. Community, health, outdoors, beauty, and I get that every day. So those things are important to me, and I am not pretending that I can solve all the world's problems, but I think I can live my life in a beautiful way and put some things out there that other people might find useful or intriguing.
Right. I mean, that's probably one of the most important takeaways here is that you are an example of what is possible. And
yeah.
Even if, you know, I can't go out and create my own Anarchy Acres, there are things about your story that make me stop and think about my own life and the life of my neighbors and the way we're all living together collectively and the ways in which we need to start thinking about some of the ways we can live differently.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the corn that you grow?
Yeah, corn is interesting to me, and I dabble in corn. I'm not a corn expert. I began growing a corn called Roy's Collet, which is a Flint corn. And it intrigued me because Roy Collet of Flint corn came from the Northeast, and we think it's the kind of corn that the Native Americans were growing there when the pilgrims arrived, when the settlers arrived. And it could be the corn that was served at the first Thanksgiving. Hmm. And if you look at that story, that's we think it's a little different than it's actually told in the children's books. But that kind of corn has been feeding people in North America for centuries. Corn is the new world crop. It's not an old world crop. And so it's a way to extract real calories out of a plot of land. Now, we have a lot of gardeners, and I'm sure I'm talking to a lot of gardeners right now. When you grow tomatoes and lettuce and things like that, those are great crops. But I don't know if you can really live on them. I'm sure there's a couple folks trying to live completely on kale. I haven't tried that yet. But, you know, sustenance comes from beans and rice, small grains like wheat. Of course, there's barley and rye out there, too. So when I look at my farm plot, how can I get life-sustaining calories and protein off of it? And I think the obvious way, if you live in North America, is corn, because that's been doing it for so long. It's been doing it for so well. Now, Flint corn, it's a hard corn. It's not a sweet corn. You're not going to want to freeze it and eat it like that. But you can grind it. You make tortillas. You make hominy. You make polenta. And I've been growing that a lot. And it's also an open pollinated product, which means that I save my seed. And that's really magical. Corn is highly variable. It crosses with itself very easily. So every year it's a little bit different. So when you pick your corn, and I'll go through there with a donkey cart, and I'll have my calmest donkey on the cart, and we'll go through the field, and I'll take the dry ears, pull them off the stalk, and throw them into the cart. When I see an ear that I think is the best ear out of that field, I'll put it into a separate box, and that's my seed for next year. Now, you can't do that with any field in Wisconsin. All the corn that you see has been double-crossed, and of course it's also patented, and it's actually illegal to take that ear corn and stick it back in the ground. But when I look at that ear, I'm my own Monsanto, okay? I look at the stalk. Did the stalk fall over or not? If it was a strong stalk, that's a candidate for saving the seed. If the ear peeled off in the right way so that the shucks were protecting the seed from rotting, that's another good sign. And if when I open it up, I see that they're plump seeds and a full ear, that's another sign. So I'm selecting every year for the qualities of the corn that grow well in my plot every year. And it's really magical. It's beautiful, and farmers have been doing it for 10,000 years. And I think anyone should and could participate in that.
Hmm. How many ears per stalk of this particular kind of corn?
I'm seeing two a lot. Okay. Yeah, a lot of them have two. And somebody gave me some Flint corn. Professor Bill Davidson in Illinois is really excited about corn. He gave me some of his Flint corn this year. And there's an ear in my plot that's 6 feet off the ground. The wow. Stalk is about, I measured it, it's 11 feet 5 inches. Oh. And the ear is 6 feet off the ground. So I don't know what that means, but it's interesting, and I can't wait to eat it and see what it tastes like.
You know, when you talk about food being patented,
yeah,
and it being illegal to take an ear of corn and stick it back in the ground, I live in a mostly rural area and surrounded by corn and beans and corn and beans. And to look at the corn at the end of my hay field and know that that's a patented thing, it's not available to everybody, in other words, is a troubling thing. Mm-hmm. You know, this is our, well, that's of course grown for cattle, but in the end it's our food, and yet it's illegal to have free access to it.
Right. It raises some troubling
it
questions.
It raises certainly. Troubling questions.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Open pollinated corn, saving seed, open pollinated plants are fantastic, and mm-hmm. I think everyone should consider them in their food cycle.
As you've been describing the work that you do on your farm and the way you do your work, I'm reminded of something I learned from a documentary many, many, many years ago about the Amish.
Okay.
And how the Amish, at least at one point in time, maybe this has changed a bit now, made very deliberate choices about what they would allow or not allow on their farms. And that in many, many cases, they were specifically rejecting ways of farming that would save time. Because in their mind, and in terms of their system of beliefs, that time spent farming was valuable time. I mean, when a father and his sons were out in the field working together, that time in and of itself had value. And so it was contrary to everything they stood for to come up with a way in which you wouldn't have to do that for as long. I mean, they wanted the act of farming to take time. And so they specifically rejected certain modern conveniences that would have streamlined it and made it efficient in a sense. I wonder, I'm not saying you're Amish, but I wonder if you see any parallel, if you see any parallel to what you are doing, the fact that the way you're doing much of this is, at least in some respects, maybe not as efficient, and yet that very inefficiency, in a sense, also has kind of value or benefit for you.
I think everything you do on a farm has value, and I think we're really in a special, interesting historical moment. For most of the 19th and 20th century, people wanted to leave the farm, and they wanted to leave it for the opportunity and the glitter of the city. But with our interconnected world now, you're not so isolated on a farm anymore.
Hmm.
You're close to services and the things that people want. People want to feel connected. They want to be connected to culture and entertainment. And in the 19th century, you couldn't blame a person for wanting to leave the farm because there's so much exciting things. There's movies, there's vaudeville in the city, and on the farm there's nothing. And you've got to be really a stalwart, old school Amish person to shun all that. But today you can live on a farm. Transportation is good. You're connected to all sorts of great ideas, too. You're connected to other anarchy acres across the country of people messing around with old wheat and old corn, and you can talk to them at night on the internet and get more ideas. So that sense of isolation is gone. And you're absolutely right. Time spent in the field is never wasted. It's exercise. It's being outside. It's experiencing beauty. It's solving problems. It's confronting challenge. It's different every time. The weather's different every time. The climate and the seasons are revealing themselves differently every year. And it's everything that we need. So I put it out there. Instead of having the food come to you so easily the way it does to us now and getting our challenge off of some contrived video game, I think the older system where the challenge is made for you from nature and your food production system is it's more fulfilling, it's healthier, and it's more beautiful. To me, it's a little crazy to see a society where we work very, very hard to avoid work. You know, all the cars and the elevators. I go to a gym that's got an elevator. Okay, I mean, people use the gym to go up to the second floor to lift weights.
I'm also a little amazed that you would belong to a gym. I should think your farm is gym, plenty of gym, isn't it?
That's a holdover from when I lived in the city, and I still teach three or four classes a week there, yoga, spinning, and things like that. And it does feel crazy to work really hard in the morning and then go teach a class at the gym and to meet people there who spent the day on a riding lawnmower and a car having to undo the damage that they did during the day from sitting in an office all day long. So I think we can take, as intelligent people in our age, take some of what I'm saying and some of what you're already doing and what you want and make a better life for yourself and for the world.
Charlie Tennyson owns a farm called Anarchy Acres, and as you have been hearing over the last few minutes, has created a really beautiful life, and it's a life that can inspire the rest of us to maybe ask some questions about the lives that we are living. Charlie, what is the address of the website for Anarchy Acres?
Just like it sounds, www.anarchyacres.com.
Very good. Charlie Tennyson, it's been a great pleasure to meet you, and very, very best wishes to you. Happy farming, happy growing.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Nan,
You're
for inviting
welcome.
Me.
Nan, do you have any events you want to tell us about in the next minute and a half?
I certainly do. Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center will be having its annual fall festival on September 17th from 11 till 4 p.m. There will be food, music, tours, games, all kinds of demonstrations. If you've been there before, you know what it's like. If you've never been there before, you need to go. It's lots of fun. On September 7th, Hoy Audubon will be featuring a program at the North Side branch of the Kenosha Public Library. At 7 p.m., Judy Grasser will share her passion for monarch butterflies and information on how to create a monarch way station. And, of course, we all know that's all about native plants. So you should go to that, too. And Sino Conservancy, October 14th from 3 till 9 p.m., we'll be having our annual Woodland Festival with a barn dance and a pig roast. There will be food and music all day, wine, beers, vendors, demonstrations, tours, fun things for the kids to do, all kinds of really cool stuff. That's October 14th from 3 until 9 p.m. at Sino Conservancy.
Fantastic. Nan Calvert, always great to see you, and thank you for bringing Charlie Tennyson with you today.
Purely my pleasure. Thank you, Greg.
We'll see you in September. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I will be speaking with Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, and with him, two representatives of the Real School in the Racine Unified School District, a very, very exciting and innovative school. Next week, among other things, I'll be speaking with the executive director of the Chicago Hazelton Betty Ford Addiction Center. And we'll be talking about opioid addiction, which, of course, is a scourge across the nation, and find out about some of the ways in which innovative treatments have been developed to try to confront this really serious problem. 1 week from today, by the way, I'll be speaking with sociology professor Next Wednesday, I'll be speaking with Wayne Thompson, sociology professor at Carthage College. We'll be looking at the root causes of racism 1 week from today, which is September 1st. I look forward to talking with Chancellor Debbie Ford.